Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting Podcast. Visit our website at www.oalaig.org, where you'll find three separate speaker feeds with over 200 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Martha.
Thanks, Batusa. My name's Martha. I'm a compulsive overeater and bulimic. And it's an honor to be asked to do anything for OA. I didn't always feel this way, but now I know this program really saved my life, and literally saved my life and gave me a much better life. And I would like to thank Nikki for inviting me to speak here, and also my sponsor, Leslie, and all my sisters in abstinence, like Lucy and Atusa and Veronica and Brooke. I'll give you my sort of statistics. I'm coming up, January 5th will be 3 years for me without vomiting, which is a miracle because I had been overeating and vomiting on and off since the age of 17, so for well over 20 years before I came here. And, you know, I've been obsessed with my body and with food since probably like about 9 years old. I've yo-yoed up and down from about 110 pounds to 145 pounds, like more times than I can count. You know, it's to this for the longest time, not so much anymore, but you could look in my closet and think that it belonged to several people because I had like some size zeros and some size tens and everything in between, and I would never get rid of anything because you never knew when I was going to need it again. And I remember my sister, both of my sisters are total normies. I'm also in AA, so, and it's weird because like when we were growing up, my sisters were all my siblings were like drugging and drinking and shoplifting, and I was the super straight A goody two shoes. And then, you know, as it turns out, I have like, you know, this hideously destructive eating disorder and an alcoholic. So, but my sister just like very innocently commented once, like, she's like, it must be so hard to shop because you just never know what size you're going to be. And I was like, yeah, that's kind of true. But let me tell you, you know, just to paraphrase somebody who from another program, but food has always fixed in me something that really needs fixing. Like, I grew up in a really kind of crazy, unstable environment. And when I'm going to just, like, keep an eye on time because I have a tendency to spend too much time in what it was like and how crazy my eating and my eating disorder was, because it sort of still fascinates me to this day. So, basically, my dad's Israeli, Yemenite Israeli. He has lived in a state of PTSD since 17. Like, he lied about his age to fight in the war for independence for Israel, and he saw his best friend exploded, and he spent time in prisoner of war camp in Jordan. He has, like, shrapnel in his head. And then he just became, like, sort of a traveling mystic, and then he accidentally came to Canada to make some money and accidentally met my mother, who was a very tightly wound, nervous wreck of a British nurse. And they accidentally got married. Well, first she accidentally got pregnant, and then within 4 years they had four kids. And just, like, my dad was not, he just doesn't live in reality, which, you know, I'm comfortable saying that now because I have made amends to him and I have a great relationship with him, and he's an amazing spiritual man, but he just didn't live in the real world, and he didn't ever plan on being saddled with a wife and all these kids. So he just, like, moved all over the place, and we lived in all these different parts of Canada, and my mother didn't work either. She still doesn't know how to drive. Like, they're just not, my parents are not of the everyday world, and we were always on welfare or taking handouts from relatives or the Jewish community. And I always comment on this because it's very weird being Jewish on welfare. That's about all I have to say about that. There's, like, certain expectations of being Jewish that do not involve poverty and welfare. And for me, like, and so it was just like this world of, like, secrets and lies of, like, because there was no obvious way to explain why our family was so poor and why we, like my dad moved us once when he was fleeing creditors, and we were, like, squatting in this Israeli guy's apartment building in an empty apartment, and we weren't going to school, and he changed our last name, and there were just, like, so many things you couldn't explain that I just kind of, like, and with my siblings, everybody had different stories going at whatever school we happened to be at. So it was just, like, I basically just, like, lived in my imagination, and I lived in books, and We were also like very health food, so food at our house was like, you know, lentils, rice, and tofu. So whenever I was at somebody else's, some kid's birthday party of their house, I would just be so excited to eat like hot dogs and candy and McDonald's or whatever. And so whenever I would have been a chubby kid and an overeater, but I didn't have the opportunity to do so. But whenever I did, I just would stuff my face and get this. But there was nothing was ever enough. Like whatever. I mean, I just remember, like, I to this day, I can conjure up these like very vivid memories of longing for more ice cream, like at an ice cream parlor or at somebody's house. Like, just I would get this sense of like sweet satisfaction from whatever I ate, and then it was not enough. And then I was like, how can I get some more? And I did that like with books and everything. I remember like having a meltdown at the library because if you were under 9, you could only take out 5 books. And then the thought of like when I would run out of those stories, like what was I going to do? And then my other thing, like my other sort of way of self-soothing, I just like had this whole thing that this wasn't my real life. Like I lived in my mind. So I, you know, at school I was always the new kid. I was like really unathletic. Like that's an understatement. Like I'm physically retarded to this day. Like I can't parallel park. I get mixed up between left and right, and I was like, you know, handicapped kids would be picked ahead of me for teams. And that's totally not making that up. And I was really ugly, and I had huge glasses and eczema and like just like the eye patch for the wandering eye, and I was like really a social misfit and all that stuff. So I would just like hide out in the bathroom at recess and live in my imaginary world. And then, you know, things got better when I got older, but I remember, like, a little bit, you know. I just had all my escapes, everything was hinging on, like, I did really well in school, and I was a great reader, and I studied really hard, and so I had this whole vision of how I would escape this crazy family life by just doing really well in school and getting away. But I did always have that food as an escape. So I remember, like, times when I was little, I would, like, steal quarters out of my dad's pockets and go like buy M&Ms and like savor them and little things like that. And then I remember, like, I would say my eating, my food as a solution kind of took off when I was about 14. I lied about my age to get a job at McDonald's, and I just like went, you know, I loved it. I mean, I loved, one of the many things I came to love in OA is just that constant identification that we get from hearing other people's stories with food. And when I first heard the term volume eater, I was like, yeah, because it's really weird how much I can eat because I'm not a big person. And, but, you know, like my ex-husband was a football linebacker in college and with a playing weight of 260, but I can eat the same amount of food as him. Like, it's just, I can put away a lot of food. And I remember, like, working at McDonald's, just, like, stuffing my face and then going home and eating whatever rice and tofu concoction was on the stove. And when I was, like, 9, I started obsessing over, like, calories and size. And so I would, like, you know, have food as an escape and then obsess about my body and control it and exercise and do all this kind of stuff. And then I started... when I did end up escaping, using like my strategies of escape and getting out of that family, and I got a scholarship to a boarding school, an international boarding school on Vancouver Island. We were living in Vancouver at the time, and it was an incredible opportunity, incredible. But you know, just because my strategy has always been, if reality is too scary and too overwhelming and too weird or too like there's discomfort about what people think, like I have to create an alternate reality or whatever. So I. You know, there were so many incredible opportunities and challenges at that school, and it was out in the forest, and we did all these outdoor activities, and this incredible academic environment with some of, like, the smartest kids in the world, and, you know, I could do some of that, but I also just was binge eating cafeteria food, and I gained, like, 25 pounds in a few months, which is a lot on a small body, and, like, just felt hideous. And then I'd always been really into, like, after-school specials and young adult novels, so I knew all about eating disorders. And I'd always, like, dreamed of being... I just thought being anorexic would be so cool, like, just to have that level of control and discipline. But that I knew that would never work for me. So bulimia seemed really good, too, because I love that idea that rules don't apply to me. I've always had that. It's like, you know, I park where I want. I fight my way out of penalties that I should have to pay. I, like... you know, I want to eat whatever I want and not get fat. Like, I get extensions on every paper and project because, you know, I'm so creative, I need more time. And, like, just, you know, bulimia seemed perfect. And, you know, I quickly became very good at it. Sometimes to this day I can slip into that, having, like, a weird pride at what a skillful vomiter I was, like, silent, fast, you know, strategic, know how to, you know, layer things and get it in and out. And so I did that as sort of, like, a weight control technique for, you know, on and off for a few years, and it kind of worked. And let's see, basically, like, I always just had to have some solution. So when things were going better in other areas of my life, like when I was really succeeding academically, like I ended up getting a scholarship to Yale and doing really well there, and I fell in love and had a really serious boyfriend, and I had, you know, lots of things seemed to be really good, and I felt like I was escaping, like, you know, my life was going in the direction that I thought it should, then, you know, my food would sort of clean up. And, you know, I never thought of myself as bulimic, even though, even in the years when I wasn't, like, terribly bulimic, I would still strategically throw up when I felt like I ate too much. But it just seemed like a normal thing to me. Like, it didn't seem like, I mean, it was a secret, but for some reason my mind thought it was, like, okay. Like, it's just what I do. Wanted to kind of accelerate through this part, but, you know, when things were going pretty well, I just felt like I was a normal eater, and I went through a whole period in my 20s, like, I went to sort of graduate school and did really well there, but, you know, I've also just always had this thing of, like, I think this is, like, the hallmark of everyone who has our disease, is just that I don't like life on life's terms. I don't like things that are difficult. I don't like things that are scary. I don't, you know, I have that take my toys and go home syndrome. When things don't turn out the way I think they should, I'll just leave. And, you know, what I was seeing in grad school, like, I like to apply for stuff and win stuff and get grants and get accolades and, like, you know, be admired. I remember somebody in one of the rooms once said, like, I always wanted to be envied rather than loved, and that was kind of how I felt. Like, I wanted my life to look really good and people to envy it, and then who cares what kind of junk is going on in the inside. And then, so, you know, grad school, it would have been, like, another, like, 5 years of, like, intensive research and study and economic uncertainty and all that stuff, and it just seemed like, whenever things are just too much, I just leave. Like, relationships or, you know, school or jobs, I just want, like, a really... I want to be, like, cocooned in, like, flannel pajamas and down duvets and have the phone unplugged and eat ice cream and just, like, I want, like, safety. I want my life to feel like a cocoon. And I know that's not the case anymore. Like, I've learned how much joy there is in just, you know, like, I can't remember a chapter of the 12 and 12 that just talks about the happiness that comes from obligations squarely met and from just doing what we're supposed to do in our life and the spirituality of just doing what I've promised that I'm going to do. And, you know, that's the kind of happiness that I find now, but it was really different for me then. Anyway, so I left grad school and I had this corporate career, and, you know, nothing really turned out the way I thought it was, and I didn't get married, and I didn't have kids, and I, like, derailed a couple of jobs, and, you know, I made tons of money and lost tons of money in that tech stock boom, and I just, through it all, like, one thing I did, too, that I've also heard people talk about in these rooms that's helped me a lot is, like, I think I disguised my compulsive overeating with sort of, like, gourmet trappings. Like, I became a really good cook, and I'd have these fantastic dinner parties, but everything was an excuse for my drinking and my overeating. And, you know, I remember, like, going to this, like, butcher shop and buying, like, three kinds of duck fat. Stuff like that, and just making these, like, elaborate dishes, and then, you know, if I ate too much, I would just throw up. I mean, that was just, like, it seems like that's what the Romans did, you know. I just didn't really see a problem with it. And then the way it all, it's hard for me. I know this is Overeaters Anonymous, but a lot of my abuse of food is tied up with my abuse of alcohol, and when one was up, the other was down, and things like that. But when I was getting really, you know, early to mid-30s is kind of when the wheels came off. And just to give you a snapshot of that period, and then I'll move on to recovery, but, like, I had basically destroyed my finances, lost, I think I lost, like $80,000 in the stock market, and lost this condo that I owned and all kinds of stuff. And none of my relationships were turning out, and I was getting a bad reputation from some of my party behavior. And so I just couldn't deal with anything. And so just a very, like, typical weekend for me would be, like, I'd have some work contracts, so I'd be at a client's office, and the only way I'd get through it would be thinking about what alcohol and food I was going to buy at the end of the day. And I would go to some supermarket, buy 2 bottles of wine, buy, like, a whole bunch of, like, frozen food and just junk. And then I'd get, like, a whole set of, like, a whole season of some series, like Six Feet Under or something suitably morbid. And then I would just, like, get mildly drunk, stuff my face, throw up, get more drunk, throw up, get... eat more, throw up, and the whole time it would be like I'd park my car 2 blocks away so no one knew I was home, my phones would be unplugged, and then I just felt like I had stopped time, like, I felt like I was taking a break from life, and that nothing was really going on, and then I'd get out of this, and it would all become better, like, I sort of, like, believed that somehow, that was real, like, I mean, just, it just got really, really bad, and then I got this idea that my salvation was, I started dating this guy I knew in college who lived down here in L.A., and we had started this, like, crazy long-distance relationship, and I was always looking for, like, some answer to, like, what was wrong with me, to, like, this constant, like, anxiety and discomfort and fear and, like, just how, I just could never get over, like, how different my life looked from the way it was supposed to, and how, like, uncomfortable I felt, and how, like, everybody else seemed to be doing so much better, and like, I'd get obsessed with the past and all this kind of stuff. And I ended up, a lot of different things happened, but I moved down here to be with him in L.A. I'd gotten sober in AA, and this was totally against sponsor direction. I think I had maybe, like, 7 or 8 months of sobriety. And I was still, like, on and off throwing up, but that sort of seemed like it wasn't really happening or wasn't my real problem, and, you know, whatever the craziness was. And I came down here, you know, we were going to get engaged, and this was just going to solve all my problems, basically, like becoming a wife and a mother. And he had these 2 little girls. His wife had been killed by a drunk driver when the little girls were 3 months old and 3 years old. And I'd been involved with them for a couple of years, and I came down here, and then I'd been here maybe 5 weeks, and I found a lump in my breast on Molly's 8th birthday. And then 2 weeks after that, I was diagnosed with a very aggressive, invasive breast cancer, and it had gotten into one of my lymph nodes, and it was, like, an advanced stage 2/borderline stage 3, and it was just nonstop, almost a whole year of, like, I had 4 surgeries, I had really intense chemotherapy and this other experimental drug, and it was just crazy fear. And I had only just started to sort of work the steps in AA, but not really. I just didn't really fully. I'd always been into, like, psychiatrists and coaches and, you know, everything else that I thought would solve my problems, and I just didn't wholeheartedly believe in this stuff. And I certainly wasn't dealing with my eating disorder. That just seemed like, I don't know. And it was really weird, because I remember, you know, being given all this, like, anti-nausea stuff, and, like, them talking to me about vomiting and all this kind of stuff, and it's just, like, that's such not an issue for me. It's just so, I don't know, like, who wouldn't want to vomit? It just seemed, and I remember I had this vision that I would get really skinny, because I'd seen lots of really skinny cancer people in movies, and instead I got, like, bloated from cortisol drugs and all this kind of stuff, and I was just so, like, dissatisfied with, you know. And then I, even though, you know, I was being told, I went to this oncology nutritionist and all this stuff, I was still, like, on and off binging and purging. And what made it so much worse is, like, I really, really, like, it was my dream to be a mom, and I was getting to be a full-time mom to these little girls who were so precious to me. And I was, you know, teaching them about nutrition and cooking them all this food. Sandra B., who's in these rooms, she just shares about, like, what a torture it is to be a mother and being trying so hard to be a healthy model for your kids and to feed them well. And you can't, like, against your own will, you're driving around binge eating. And I just remember this one time. I just never, ever want to forget this. If I ever, ever think that I'm normal and that I can just go out there and, like, you know, eat with the normies. I dropped Maddie off at this kindergarten party where you were, it was, it's, parents are so excited when it's a drop-off party because you don't have to stay with your kids. And so, but she was howling and she didn't want me to leave and she was clinging to my hand. But my whole vision was like I knew exactly where I was going to drive, what food I was going to get, and where I was going to throw up and how I would get back, clean up and get back in time to pick her up. And I remember yanking her hand out of mine and like leaving her there at that party and this, telling this other, lying to some other mom and saying I had an emergency at the house I had to get to. And just like, and then like the more you do stuff like that, the more you have to eat because you can't live with that feeling that you've just like broken your little kid's heart. And, you know, and that was like while I was in cancer treatment. I mean, it was just craziness. And what ended up happening, like, this is kind of more my AA story, but, you know, I just got into so much self-pity and such a lack of recovery, spiritual recovery, in my that year of cancer that I just unraveled everything. I ended up one night just putting like a bunch of vanilla and some hot milk because I just really needed to relax, and that was like enough alcohol to set me off. And I ended up relapsing and losing that marriage and losing those kids. And I had destroyed everything in my life. I was locked up in a hotel room trying to kill myself for a couple of days and not having the courage to go through with it. I ended up in a lockdown, full-on like lockdown mental ward for 10 days, and it was really hard to get out because I kept trying to kill myself while I was locked up too. And the only thing this is so horrible to say, but when I got out of there and I was like remanded into inpatient treatment for bulimia, depression, and alcohol, and God, you know, everything else that's wrong with me. But I just remember being so excited at how thin I was because I was so, you know, horribly depressed and everything that I couldn't eat. And I remember, like, looking in the mirror before I went into inpatient treatment, like, admiring the way my hip bones stuck out of my jeans. And then, you know, when I was in that treatment center, you know, I had to go to, like, this nutritionist and this food recovery group and all this kind of stuff and, you know, explore all the underlying causes of my eating disorder. But it just didn't all really seem that serious to me. All I wanted to do was prove my sobriety and win back my husband and those children. And, you know, it didn't work out that way. And what happened, though, is I had a moment of spiritual surrender, actually, when I was, like, locked up in that in the nut house, and I did totally throw myself into AA and really start to work the steps in that program. And, you know, I started to find this incredible freedom, and the compulsion to drink was completely removed from me. And there were a number of other things that, like, just evidence that God was working in my life, in the sense, like, I believed in the miracle of the steps, and I believed that there was a God working in my life. But what ended up happening is, like, the more, you know, I still have this total, I default to, like, just not being able to function in the world and not being able to accept things as they are. And as it turns out, you know, so recovery in one program is not a solution to what we have as overeaters and as bulimics. And the more recovery I gained in that program, the worse my eating disorder got. And at the same time, I was still finishing cancer treatment at that time, and I remember I was going to this oncology nutritionist who had me on this program of, like, you know, eating the rainbow, fruits and vegetables, and, like, you know, it was very specific, all the stuff I had to do, and it was recommended to me because of the type of breast cancer I had to get my body fat. Was, like, supposed to be in the low 20s, and it was, like, mine was actually 29, even though I wasn't that heavy. It's like I'm this little popsicle stick wrapped in bacon or something. And I just was, like, I wasn't exercising, and so I would do this program that she gave me, like, for 3 or 4 days, and I would just feel amazing, and then I would be, like, hitting 4 drive-throughs and throwing up 4 times. And I just couldn't, like, all of it just seemed to be, like, against my own will, you know. And what ended up happening is my AA sponsor could see she said, you're going to drink over this. You know, I'd be at a meeting, we have this women's meeting that we go to in our group where there's all this food out, and I would eat half the food on the table and then miss part of the meeting because I was in the bathroom throwing up, and I just thought it was, like, really secretive the way I was doing it. And so that sponsor told, we're in the same home group as Leslie, and she said, why don't you go talk to Leslie, because she hasn't thrown up in 22 years, and whatever she tells you to do, I want you to do it. And I'm like, oh, okay. But I was completely unwilling, and I just remember, like, we're in a super strong, super structured, really rigorous, like, you know, our home group needs business. And I just came to OA and thought it was all like weak and watered down and lame, and I just didn't want to hear people talk about their problems, and I didn't want to identify. And but I was following Spencer's direction, and what happened is I came for a few months. I got instant recovery. I stopped throwing up. I got fit, lost some weight. I felt like I was done. And so I just told Leslie that I wasn't coming back. And then I said, well, what do you think? And she said, well, Martha, I don't think there's such a thing as social vomiting. I think that, she said, I think that you're probably going to be back. She said, I think you'll probably be throwing up again soon. And I was just like, God, she doesn't know anything. And then within probably 4 or 5 weeks, I was throwing up again. And, you know, we talk about how this is a progressive illness. I can tell you that that was absolutely the case for me, because in the following, like, 5 months, it got worse than it had ever, ever been. I mean, I was throwing up 5 or 6 times a day. I was, like, disappearing from work and eating. I was throwing up in my car in bags. I was, like, It was like one long blackout, but I was too proud to come back, and I could see how it was destroying all parts of my life, but I was like, well, I'm sober, and, you know, this is just a phase, and honestly, I don't even know what I was thinking, but I couldn't come back. I was too proud, and it just seemed so ridiculous to me to have to go to 2 12-step programs. Like, that just seemed so wrong on so many levels. It was like, what about my life? Like, when am I going to, like, have a boyfriend, or when am I, you know, just, like, you think about, like, the amount of time and money you spend, for me, the amount of time and money and insanity and, like, the mental real estate that's consumed by this disease, and then to think that I don't have time to, like, go to extra meetings, you know. It's crazy. And I'll tell you, I really like to share this story because we may not know it, but we carry the message everywhere we go, like, just by our behavior and what we do in our everyday life. Because I'd gone to this New Year's Day party, this, like, chili party in our home group they have every year, stuffed my face, I couldn't talk to anybody, I was like, all I could think about is how much I could eat there, where I would go next, what food I was going to get, where I was going to throw up, then what I was going to do, and then how I would, like, numb out with movies or something and hide. And that was going to be my New Year's Day, and that was in 2009. And then I went that night. I was at the Whole Foods in Santa Monica, and I'd went in kind of thinking I would just get something healthy, but I didn't really think that. And then there's a lot of unhealthy food at Whole Foods. So I had, like, some giant vat of lasagna and a 6-pack of Devil's Food Cake cupcakes, and I was going to just eat it in my car and throw up. It was like a done deal. And I was in the elevator going down, and Michael was in there, and I'd remembered him from an OA meeting. And he had clearly, like, lost another 50 pounds at least, and he didn't remember me, and I just didn't even make eye contact with him, but he was, like, making chipper conversation with people in the elevator, and, like, I could see the food in his grocery bag was, like, super healthy food, and he radiated happiness, and I wanted to feel, like, the way he looked. I wanted to feel, like, the happiness that was radiating from him. And I could see the difference between him when I knew him, like, 6 or 7 months ago in OA, or when I saw him around, and when I saw him that day. And so it was like everything about that moment was a testament that OA worked. And so in my head I was just like, oh, F it, I guess I'm going back to OA. And I went back the next day. And then I think I threw up the day after that. And then the day after that was my abstinence date. And I've held on to that. Like I will hold on to that. And I will do anything to hold on to that date, because I do not want to live in that world again. That was a horrible, horrible, horrible way to live, especially once I had been in OA and had a little bit of recovery and left with my pride and stubbornness and total unwillingness to surrender. And I came back, and it was, and I was too proud to ask Leslie to sponsor me again, because I hated it that she was right. I still struggle with how much she's right all the time. Like, I'll go do something my way and do something, and then it's like, damn it, she's right again. So, just this year alone, she basically talked me out of moving back to Canada, because it was already a done deal in my mind, and she basically told me to stop talking about it, stop thinking about it, and invest in my life here. And, you know, like, she just kept going, you don't know what God has in store for you. And in my head, I'm like, yeah, I freaking do, and it's terrible. This, like, sucks. And then I followed some simple direction from her, and, like, a whole bunch of things in my life completely turned around, and now I'm getting a green card, and I got a promotion at work, and I have a boyfriend, and, like, just all these things. Anyway, and so I was just like, But back then, I did, after about 3 or 4 months of other OA sponsors who were, like, much easier on me and told me to, like, take baths and tell myself that I loved myself. And, like, you know, I went back to the tough love approach, luckily, which is always like, why don't you think about yourself a little less and why don't you see who you can help? There's, like, no need to go to the spa. So I did end up asking her to sponsor me. And I just wanted to tell you, too, like, you know, our school of sponsorship, and this is how I sponsor the girls that I've had the opportunity to sponsor a lot of girls in OA. I have 4 sponsees right now. I've had as many as 7 or 8, but a lot of people don't really want to do the work that we kind of do in our lineage, I guess. And it's 5 meetings a week and 5 commitments and 3 outreach calls a day and taking on any service position that you're asked to do, speaking when you're asked to speak. And I call Leslie every day, no matter what, doing my step work as it's assigned. You know, it's pretty serious. And that I did, like what happened when I surrendered in AA. When I totally surrendered in OA, the compulsion to throw up was gone, and it has never come back, and it's never occurred to me to throw up. And I can't explain that. I mean, but I struggled for probably 1.5 years with binge eating, and I gained weight. And I hated the way I looked, and I got into a lot of self-created misery. You know, I love both the Big Book and the 12 and 12 talk about how all of my problems are of my own making, and I had a lot of problems that were of my own making. I still, like, periodically isolated, I binge ate, I didn't exercise, you know, I didn't use everything that was available to me in this program. And then God bless Leslie for this too, and I know Brooke, you talked about this as well, you know, because I kept wanting to change my abstinence to be no binge eating, no vomiting, you know, add all these things, no sugar, and Leslie's like, why don't you just keep it really simple? Why don't you just not throw up? Why don't you just not throw up? How about that? And she's just told me, like, she's seen girls that have changed their abstinence. And, you know, if you start doing no binging and then you binge and you have to start over, like, why wouldn't you just start throwing up again? And she said, and I've seen this now so many times, that a lot of girls, when people start throwing up again, sometimes you can't stop. Like, sometimes you get back into that. And I don't want to die that way. And I've seen people in this program, in and out of these rooms, like bulimics, that are dying of bulimia. And I've known people that have died of all the health complications of that. And because of my cancer risk and everything else that's going on, I can't take a risk like that, you know. So I'm just keeping it really simple. And I just one day at a time, I don't throw up. And then, like, everything Leslie said in terms of, like, if I just keep showing up, I keep doing what I did, another set of steps with her. You know, if I just keep doing the stuff I'm supposed to do, I started sponsoring a lot. I made a lot of food-related amends. Actually, I have to go back to all these I used to, like, go to the Whole Foods salad bar. I think it's way overpriced, so I would eat about half of what I bought before I paid for it to bring it down to a reasonable price range. And Leslie's point was, like, well, if you don't like their prices, you don't have to shop there. So I went back to, like, 5 Whole Foods and a Ralph's, and I basically just have to find a manager and say, you know, I'm in a 12-step recovery program, and I used to, like, you know, eat your salad bar food without paying for it. I didn't say because I thought it was overpriced. And then I paid them back. And some of them took my money, just rang it up as a purchase. Some of it was really amazing. Like, this one guy, the place I stole the most from, it was about $120 because I used to do it all the time. He looked like he was going to cry. And he said, you know, you don't have to do this. Nobody knew about it. And I said, well, I have to do this because this is how I'm going to stay, going to keep my recovery, because I can't live with the bad things that I've done, and I need to live a clean and honest life. And he started telling me about how he has these 2 drug addicted nephews who've been in and out of recovery, and he really wants them to get it. And he just, like, he held my hand, he just, like, touched my arm, and he was like, I really, really commend you for what you're doing, and you're inspirational. And he said, you know, there's a lot of hungry people everywhere. My store doesn't need your money. Why don't you just donate it to somebody who's hungry somewhere, mm-hmm. and just keep doing what you're doing? Because the more people who are living in recovery, you know, maybe it will reach my nephews. It was really, really beautiful. And I had through all my amends, I've had amazing, amazing experiences. Like, all my relationships with my family are totally cleaned up. You know, even in recovery, like, when in my sobriety, but before I had OA recovery, like, I love my sisters. They're my best friends in the world, and I miss my family in Canada a lot, and I have these amazing nieces and nephews. And my little sister, after I made amends to her and restored that relationship, she had a little baby last December and named her after me. which is really, really amazing. And but I would visit them sometimes, and we'd have these great experiences, and then I would be, like, secret eating at night and, like, you know, throwing up in their toilets and stuff like that in recovery, in my AA recovery. And I don't do that anymore. And it just, I wish for all of you, I wish for every single person in this room to be able to have the peace that I have around food. You know, I was just at Leslie's salon. That's why my hair looks so fabulous. And there's, like, she was, like, there's this insane table of, like, Yuletide delights, which is, like, everything that I love, you know, everything chocolatey and creamy and heaps of it. And, like, in the past, even in this earlier in my recovery, like, that if I was eating it, my whole day would be lost obsessing about what I ate and how much and how was I going to get rid of it or not, or when would I eat more. Like, it would completely take me prisoner. And then if I didn't eat it, I would still be obsessed with it. But to be able to just, like, walk past it, make a joke about it to Leslie, and then to just not be interested, like, how do you explain that? You know, like, a lot of normies can't even do that. Like, just that level of peace and comfort. And then I wanted to take some questions, if you guys have any, but I just wanted to put in a plug for sponsorship, because I noticed in a lot of OA rooms, like, a lot of people either think they can't be a sponsor, or they don't have time to do it, or that they have a couple, so they're too busy to do more or whatever. But, like, that the more I sponsor and the more I put my hand out and the more I call newcomers, like, the better my recovery gets. And I wish Marina was here. She's in Portland right now, but she's a new sponsee of mine, and she's doing amazingly well. And Charlotte and Sally, who just moved to New York. But, like just to see the miracle take place in their life. Like, even I can be having the worst day when I'm screwing up at work and hating myself and, like, mad at somebody in my head or, you know, whatever. Like, we all have those times in recovery. And then I'll get some urgent text or some call from one of my sponsees, and then I give them some direction. That's usually, like, a verbatim repetition of something Leslie has said to me, because everything she said to me is, like, burned in my brain. And then they'll text me back or call me and be like, oh, my God, this happened and that happened, and then my boss said this. And then, like, that's how I constantly see the miracle working, and that's how I get better. You know what I mean? Like, and it makes me walk the walk. Like, I behave so much better when my sponsees are around, or, like, when I'm meeting them to do something. And then also, like, it keeps me in my step work, because I have all my original step work in this, like, tabbed binder, and it's all organized, and then my additional step work is in a supplementary section, and then I, like, but I have to, like, every time I go back to that, it's so exciting, because I remember, like, I did all this stuff for 6 and 7, and then I listened to this Sandy Beach CD, and then this happened. Oh my God, I forgot about that. So I have to, like, continually pass it on, or it's just not, like, that is the solution to ever, you know. And just the constant, like, the level of, the way my relationship with God has completely transformed through just continuing to see the miracles in my life and others. It just becomes where I just continually talk to God during the day, and all of that is just kind of integrated into my day, if that makes any sense. So I guess it's already kind of too late. Like, maybe, oh, thank you for letting me share, and then if anybody has any questions. I guess it's more like just a feeling. I sort of, because I'm very, like, weirdly obsessive, and I'm very listy. I always have a lot of lists. So I keep lists of, like, all the miracles. And then I just think about them. And then I do that golden key thing from that Emmett Fox little golden key thing where you just repeat, like, God is joy, God is peace, God is freedom, God surrounds me with his love. And it's, like, sort of a mantra, I guess. And it's just this feeling. Like, and then I just, like, and sometimes he's kind of more of a person that's all powerful, and sometimes he's just, like, this force. And, I guess the experiences with God, like, every time I'm totally open to a new experience with God, and every time I surrender something completely, which is very hard for me to do, but when I do, like, just amazing things happen. So it's more like just a feeling that envelops me, I guess. I just think about all the other examples of things that I have surrendered and what happened. And then I think about how much suffering am I willing. Like, I guess I have to get into a lot of suffering to surrender. Like, because I can really delude myself into thinking that my control and managed systems are working. And then, but I guess, you know what, it's all about sponsorship and being sponsored, too. Because I'll just, even if I know I'm not taking the right actions, like I just did that the other day with Leslie, like there was something I knew I was supposed to be doing and I wasn't doing it, but I called her and told her that I wasn't doing it and I wasn't willing, and then she left me a message and I listened to it and then I surrendered it, and it was a work project that I had to get done, and then it turned out amazing, you know what I mean? Or I'm just like telling a sponsee about it and I realize what I'm not surrendering and how, like, and I'll hear the freedom in her voice, in the sponsee's voice, and I compare that with the knots in my stomach and the fear, and I don't want that, you know? Like, I want my life to keep getting better and better, and it is. But it's really hard. Okay. Oh, sorry, we're done. But ask me afterwards. Thank you.